4. In 1993, 12 years after becoming chief executive of General Electric, Jack Welch traveled to Tokyo and, while touring a factory that made medical testing equipment, heard a story about Japan's railway system. In the 1950s, during the lingering wake of the devastation of the Second World War, Japan was intensely focused on growing the nation's economy. A large portion of the country's population lived in or between the cities of Tokyo and Osaka, which were separated by just 320 miles of train track. Every day, tens of thousands of people traveled between the cities. Vast amounts of raw industrial materials were transported on those rail lines. But the Japanese topography was so mountainous and the railway system so outdated that the trip could take as long as 20 hours. So, in 1955, the head of the Japanese railway system issued a challenge to the nation's finest engineers: invent a faster train. 6 months later, a team unveiled a prototype locomotive capable of going 65 miles per hour, a speed that, at the time, made it among the fastest passenger trains in the world. "Not good enough," the head of the railway system said. He wanted 120 miles per hour. The engineers explained that was not realistic. At those speeds, if a train turned too sharply, the centrifugal force would derail the cars. 70 miles an hour was more realistic, perhaps 75. Any faster and the trains would crash. "Why do the trains need to turn?" the railway head asked. "There were numerous mountains between the cities," the engineers replied. "Why not make tunnels then?" The labor required to tunnel through that much territory could equal the cost of rebuilding Tokyo after World War II. 3 months later, the engineers unveiled an engine capable of going 75 miles per hour. The railway chief lambasted the designs. 75 miles per hour, he said, had no chance of transforming the nation. Incremental improvements would only yield incremental economic growth. The only way to overhaul the nation's transportation system was to rebuild every aspect of how trains functioned. Over the next 2 years, the engineers experimented. They designed train cars that each had their own motors. They rebuilt gears so they meshed with less friction. They discovered that their new cars were too heavy for Japan's existing tracks, so they reinforced the rails, which had the added bonus of increasing stability, which added another half mile per hour to car speed. There were hundreds of innovations, large and small, that each made the trains a little bit faster than before. In 1964, the Tokaido Shinkansen, the world's first bullet train, left Tokyo along continuously welded rails that passed through tunnels cut into Japan's mountains. It completed its inaugural trip in 3 hours and 58 minutes, at an average speed of 120 miles per hour. Hundreds of spectators had waited overnight to see the train arrive in Osaka. Soon, other bullet trains were running to other Japanese cities, helping fuel a dizzying economic expansion. The development of the bullet train, according to a 2014 study, was critical in spurring Japan's growth well into the 1980s. And within a decade of that innovation, the technologies developed in Japan had given birth to high-speed rail projects in France, Germany, and Australia, and had revolutionized industrial design around the world. For Jack Welch, this story was a revelation. What GE needed, he told Kerr when he got home from Japan, was a similar outlook, an institutional commitment to audacious goals. Going forward, every executive and department, in addition to delivering specific and achievable and timely objectives, would also have to identify a stretch goal, an aim so ambitious that managers couldn't describe, at least initially, how they would achieve it. Everyone, Welch said, had to partake in bullet train thinking. In a 1993 letter to shareholders, the chief executive explained that stretch is a concept that would have produced smirks, if not laughter, in the GE of 3 or 4 years ago, because it essentially means using dreams to set business targets, with no real idea of how to get there. If you do know how to get there, it's not a stretch target. 6 months after Welch's trip to Japan, every division at GE had a stretch goal. The division manufacturing airplane engines, for instance, announced they would reduce the number of defects in finished engines by 25%. To be honest, the division's managers figured they could hit that target pretty easily. Almost all the defects they found on engines were small, cosmetic issues, such as a slightly misaligned cable or unimportant scratches. Anything more serious was corrected before the engine was shipped. If they hired more quality assurance employees, managers figured, they could reduce cosmetic defects with little effort. Welch agreed that reducing defects was a wise goal. Then he told them to cut errors by 70%. "That's ridiculous," managers said. Manufacturing engines was such a complicated affair, each one weighed 5 tons and had more than 10,000 parts, that there was no way they could achieve a 70% reduction. They had 3 years, Welch said. The division's managers started panicking and then began analyzing every error that had been recorded in the previous 12 months. Simply hiring more quality assurance workers, they quickly realized, wouldn't do the trick. The only way to reduce errors by 70% was to make every single employee, in effect, a quality assurance auditor. Everyone had to take responsibility for catching mistakes. But most factory workers didn't know enough about the engine to identify every small defect as it occurred. The only solution, managers decided, was a massive retraining effort. Except that didn't really work either. Even after 9 months of retraining, the error rate had fallen by only 50%. So managers started hiring workers with more technical backgrounds, the kind of people who knew what an engine ought to look like, and, therefore, could more easily spot what was amiss. The GE factory manufacturing CF6 engines in Durham, North Carolina, determined that the best way to find the right employees was to hire only candidates with FAA certification in engine manufacturing. Such workers, however, were already in high demand at other plants. So to attract them, managers said employees could have more autonomy. They could schedule their own shifts and organize teams however they wanted. That required the plant to do away with centralized scheduling. Teams had to self-organize and figure out their own workflow. Welch had given his aircraft manufacturing division a stretch goal of reducing errors by 70%, an objective so audacious, the only way to go about it was to change nearly everything about A, how workers were trained, B, which workers were hired, and C, how the factory ran. By the time they were done, the Durham plant's managers had collapsed organizational charts, remade job duties, and overhauled how they interviewed candidates because they needed people with better team skills and more flexible mindsets. In other words, Welch's stretch goal set off a chain reaction that remade how engines were manufactured in ways no one had imagined. By 1999, the number of defects per engine had fallen by 75%, and the company had gone 38 months without missing a single delivery, a record. The cost of manufacturing had dropped by 10% every year. No smart goal would have done that. Numerous academic studies have examined the impact of stretch goals and have consistently found that forcing people to commit to ambitious, seemingly out-of-reach objectives can spark outsized jumps in innovation and productivity. A 1997 study of Motorola, for instance, found that the time it took engineers to develop new products fell tenfold after the company mandated stretch goals throughout the firm. A study of 3M said stretch goals helped spur such inventions as Scotch tape and Thinsulate. Stretch goals transformed Union Pacific, Texas Instruments, and public schools in Washington, D.C. and Los Angeles. Surveys of people who have lost large amounts of weight or have become marathon runners later in life have found that stretch goals are often integral to their success. Stretch goals serve as jolting events that disrupt complacency and promote new ways of thinking, a group of researchers wrote in Academy of Management Review Business Journal in 2011. By forcing a substantial elevation in collective aspirations, stretch goals can shift attention to possible new futures and perhaps spark increased energy in the organization. They thus can prompt exploratory learning through experimentation, innovation, broad search, or playfulness. There is an important caveat to the power of stretch goals, however. Studies show that if a stretch goal is audacious, it can spark innovation. It can also cause panic and convince people that success is impossible because the goal is too big. There is a fine line between an ambition that helps people achieve something amazing and one that crushes morale. For a stretch goal to inspire, it often needs to be paired with something like the SMART system. The reason why we need both stretch goals and SMART goals is that audaciousness on its own can be terrifying. It's often not clear how to start on a stretch goal. And so, for a stretch goal to become more than just an aspiration, we need a disciplined mindset to show us how to turn a far-off objective into a series of realistic short-term aims. People who know how to build SMART goals have often been habituated into cultures where big objectives can be broken into manageable parts, and so when they encounter seemingly outsized ambitions, they know what to do. Stretch goals, paired with smart thinking, can help put the impossible within reach. In one experiment conducted at Duke University, for instance, varsity athletes were asked to run around a track and, when signaled, get as close as possible to a finish line 200 meters away within 10 seconds. The runners in the study all knew, simply by looking at the distance they were being asked to cover, that the goal was absurd. No person has ever run anything close to 200 meters in 10 seconds. The athletes made it 59.6 meters on average during their sprint. A few days later, those same participants were presented with the same task, but this time the finish line was only 100 meters away. The goal was still audacious, but it was within the realm of possibility. Usain Bolt ran 100 meters in 9.58 seconds in 2009. During this trial, the runners made it, on average, 63.1 meters in 10 seconds, a large difference by track and field standards, the researchers noted. This difference in performance was explained by the fact that the shorter distance, while still challenging, lent itself to the kind of methodical planning and mental models that experienced runners are accustomed to using. The shorter distance, in other words, allowed the runners to participate in the athletic equivalent of breaking a stretch goal into SMART components. All runners in our sample engaged in regular workouts, the researchers wrote, and so when confronted with running 100 meters in 10 seconds, they knew how to wrestle with the task. They broke it into pieces and treated it like they would other sprints. They started strong and paced off other runners and then pushed themselves as hard as possible in the final seconds. But when they were confronted with running 200 meters in 10 seconds, there was no practical approach. There was no way to break the problem into manageable parts. There were no SMART criteria they could apply. It was simply impossible. Experiments at the University of Waterloo, the University of Melbourne, and elsewhere show similar results. Stretch goals can spark remarkable innovations, but only when people have a system for breaking them into concrete plans. This lesson can extend to even the most mundane aspects of life. Take, for instance, to-do lists. To-do lists are great if you use them correctly, Timothy Pitchell, a psychologist at Carleton University, told me. But when people say things like, "I sometimes write down easy items I can cross off right away because it makes me feel good," that's exactly the wrong way to create a to-do list. That signals you're using it for mood repair rather than to become productive. The problem with many to-do lists is that when we write down a series of short-term objectives, we are, in effect, allowing our brains to seize on the sense of satisfaction that each task will deliver. We are encouraging our need for closure and our tendency to freeze on a goal without asking if it's the right aim. The result is that we spend hours answering unimportant emails instead of writing a big, thoughtful memo, because it feels so satisfying to clean out our inbox. At first glance, it might seem like the solution is creating to-do lists filled solely with stretch goals. But we all know that merely writing down grand aspirations doesn't guarantee we will achieve them. In fact, studies show that if you're confronted with a list of only far-reaching objectives, you're more likely to get discouraged and turn away. So one solution is writing to-do lists that pair stretch goals and SMART goals. Come up with a menu of your biggest ambitions. Dream big and stretch. Describe the goals that, at first glance, seem impossible, such as starting a company or running a marathon. Then choose one aim and start breaking it into short-term, concrete steps. Ask yourself, what realistic progress can you make in the next day, week, month? How many miles can you realistically run tomorrow and over the next 3 weeks? What are the specific short-term steps along the path to bigger success? What timeline makes sense? Will you open your store in 6 months or a year? How will you measure your progress? Within psychology, these smaller ambitions are known as proximal goals, and repeated studies have shown that breaking a big ambition into proximal goals makes the large objective more likely to occur. When Pitchell writes a to-do list, for instance, he starts by putting a stretch goal, such as conduct research that explains goal-neurology interface, at the top of the page. Underneath comes the nitty-gritty, the small tasks that tell him precisely what to do. Specific: download grant application. Timeline: by tomorrow. That way, I'm constantly telling myself what to do next, but I'm also reminded of my larger ambition, so I don't get stuck in the weeds of doing things simply to make myself feel good, Pitchell said. In short, we need stretch and SMART goals. It doesn't matter if you call them by those names. It's not important if your proximal goals fulfill every SMART criterion. What matters is having a large ambition and a system for figuring out how to make it into a concrete and realistic plan. Then, as you check the little things off your to-do list, you'll move ever closer to what really matters. You'll keep your eyes on what's both wise and SMART. I had no idea how what we were doing would affect the rest of the world, Kerr told me. GE's embrace of SMART and stretch goals has been analyzed in academic studies and psychology textbooks. The firm's system has been imitated throughout corporate America. We proved you can change how people act by asking them to think about goals differently, said Kerr. Once you know how to do that, you can get pretty much anything done. 5. 27 days after fighting concluded in the Yom Kippur War, the Israeli parliament established a national committee of inquiry to examine why the nation had been so dangerously unprepared. Officials met for 140 sessions and heard testimony from 58 witnesses, including Prime Minister Golda Meir, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, and the head of the Directorate of Military Intelligence, Eli Zaira. In the days that preceded the Yom Kippur War, the Research Division of Military Intelligence had plenty of warning indicators, investigators concluded. There was no justification for Israel to have been caught off guard. Zaira and his colleagues had ignored obvious signs of danger. They had dissuaded other leaders from following their instincts. These mistakes were not made out of malice, investigators said, but because Zaira and his staff had become so obsessed with avoiding unnecessary panic and making firm decisions that they lost sight of their most important objective, keeping Israelis safe. Prime Minister Meir resigned 1 week after the government's report was released. Moshe Dayan, the one-time hero, was hounded by critics until his death 6 years later. And Zaira was relieved of his position and forced to resign from government service. Zaira's failings in the run-up to the Yom Kippur War illustrate one final lesson regarding how goals function and influence our psychology. He, in fact, was using both stretch and smart goals when he convinced the nation's leaders to ignore obvious signs of war. He had clear and grand ambitions to end the cycle of anxiety plaguing Israelis. He knew that his big aim was to stop the endless debates and second-guessing. And his methods for breaking those larger goals into smaller pieces involved finding proximal goals that were specific, measurable, achievable, and realistic, and that occurred according to a timeline. He remade his agency in a deliberate, step-by-step manner. He did everything that psychologists like Latham and Locke have said we ought to do in order to achieve both big and small goals. Yet Zaira's craving for closure and his intolerance for revisiting questions once they were answered are among the biggest reasons why Israel failed to anticipate the attacks. Zaira is an example of how stretch and smart goals, on their own, sometimes aren't enough. In addition to having audacious ambitions and plans that are thorough, we still need, occasionally, to step outside the day-to-day and consider if we're moving toward goals that make sense. We still need to think. On October 6, 2013, the 40th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, Elie Zaira addressed an audience of national security scholars in Tel Aviv. He was 85 years old, and his gait was a bit unsteady as he walked onto the stage. He spoke haltingly from handwritten notes. He had come to defend himself, he said. Mistakes had been made, but not just by him. Everyone had learned they needed to be more careful and less certain. They were all to blame. A former colleague in the audience began heckling him. "You are telling us fairy tales," the man shouted. "You are lying." "This is not a field court-martial," Zaira replied. The war was not his fault alone, he said. No one had been willing to stare the most terrifying possibility, a full-scale invasion, in the face. But then, in a moment of reflection, Zaira conceded that he had made an error. He had ignored the seemingly impossible. He hadn't thought through all the alternatives as deeply as he should. "I usually had a note in my pocket," he told the audience. "And on that little note, it said, 'And if not?'" The note was a talisman, a reminder that the desire to get something done, to be decisive, can also be a weakness. The note was supposed to prompt him to ask bigger questions. But in the days before the Yom Kippur War, "I didn't read that little note," Zaira said. "That was my mistake." Chapter 5. Managing Others. Solving a kidnapping with lean and agile thinking and a culture of trust. Frank Jansen had just returned home from a bike ride when he heard a knock at the front door. It was a sunny Saturday morning. There were kids playing soccer a few blocks away. When Jansen looked out the window, he saw a woman holding a clipboard and two men dressed in khakis and button-down shirts. Perhaps they were conducting a survey, or they were religious missionaries. Jansen didn't know why they were on his doorstep, but he hoped it wouldn't take more than a moment to shoo them away. When he opened the door, however, the men pushed their way inside. One of them grabbed Jansen, shoved him against the wall, and then threw him to the floor. He pulled a gun from his waistband and slammed the barrel across Jansen's face. The other man pressed a stun gun against Jansen's torso and pulled the trigger, momentarily paralyzing the 63-year-old. Then they bound his hands with a plastic zip tie and carried him outside into the back seat of a silver Nissan waiting in the driveway. The two men sat on either side of Jansen while the woman sat up front next to the driver. As Jansen slowly regained control of his body, he began shoving his attackers. They pushed him to the floor and applied the stun gun again. The car backed onto the street and headed west, past the field where kids were playing soccer. One of the assailants dropped a blanket over Jansen's body. The vehicle turned onto a freeway and slipped into southbound traffic. Jansen's wife came home about an hour later and found the house empty and the front door ajar. Frank's bike was propped against the garage. Maybe he had gone for a walk. An hour later, with no sign of him, his wife grew concerned. She searched the entryway, thinking he might have left a note. On the doorstep, she saw a few drops of blood. Panicked, she walked toward the driveway and found more blood outside. She phoned her daughter, who told her to call the police. Her husband, she explained to officers, was a consultant at a firm specializing in national security. Soon, her home was surrounded by police cruisers and yellow crime scene tape. Black SUVs pulled up, delivering a team of FBI agents who dusted for prints and photographed indentations in the grass. For the next 2 days, agents pored over Jansen's cell phone records and interviewed neighbors and coworkers, but found nothing to indicate what was going on. Then, 3 days after the abduction, in the middle of the night on April 7, 2014, his wife's phone buzzed. It was a series of text messages from an unfamiliar number with a New York City area code. "We have your husband," the texts read, "and he is in the trunk of a car going to California. If she contacted the police, we will send him back to you in 6 boxes, and every chance we get, we will take someone in your family to Italy and torture them and kill them. We will do a drive-by and gun down anybody in your family, and we will throw grenades in your window." The texts also referenced Jansen's daughter and a man named Kelvin Melton. Suddenly, things started making a bit more sense. Jansen's daughter, Colleen, was an assistant district attorney in nearby Wake Forest, and she had prosecuted Melton, a high-ranking gang member in the Bloods, a few years earlier. Colleen had successfully sent Melton to jail for the rest of his life on a charge of assault with a deadly weapon. A theory began to emerge. Government investigators suspected that the Bloods had kidnapped Frank Jansen to punish his daughter. This was revenge for putting one of their leaders behind bars. Within hours, the police had subpoenaed the records of the phones sending the texts looking for a link with known gang members. They could tell the messages had been transmitted from Georgia, but the device was a burner, an unregistered phone bought with cash at a Walmart. There was nothing in the cellular records or purchase receipts that told investigators who owned the phone or where it was currently located. 2 days later, another text arrived from a different number, this time with an Atlanta area code. "Here is 2 picture of you husband," it read, and included photos of Jansen tied to a chair. "If you cannot tell me where my things are at tomorrow, I will start torturing Colleen father." None of the investigators had any idea what things the kidnappers were referring to. The texts also demanded that someone bring Melton, the incarcerated gang leader, a pack of cigarettes, as well as other commands. Jefe wants his things, and he needs to get another phone fast so we can finish our business. And if I don't get word from him very, very fast, then we have problems with his people. The police didn't know if Jefe referred to Melton or someone else, or why Melton would want cigarettes delivered to him since he could buy them inside the Polk Correctional Institution. More texts arrived with references to unknown people. "Now he know ah playing games," one said. "Tell him we got Frano. Tell him he better find a way to tell me where my thing's at and get my money, or we kill these people in 2 days." Investigators were confused by these mentions of Jefe and Frano, and the threats to kill multiple people, even though authorities were aware of only one kidnapping victim. If this was a revenge plot, why were the kidnappers sending so many ambiguous messages? Why hadn't they made any ransom demands? One federal agent thought the kidnappers were acting as if they weren't sure what was going on themselves, as if they didn't have a plan. The FBI asked Google to look for searches around the time of the abduction that had included Jansen's address. The computer giant reported that someone using a disposable T-Mobile phone had Googled Colleen Jansen address, but what had come up was her parents' home, where she had once lived. A new theory emerged. The kidnappers had intended to kidnap Colleen as revenge for prosecuting Kevin Melton, but had accidentally grabbed her father. Investigators determined that the Georgia phone sending the latest texts was also a burner, but this time, when agents approached cellular companies, their records proved more fruitful. The texts had been sent from Atlanta. Moreover, the phone had recently received a call from another number, which had been sending and receiving texts with yet another phone that police were able to determine was located inside the walls of Polk Correctional itself. That phone had placed almost 100 calls to Melton's daughters. The kidnapping, investigators came to believe, was being directed by Melton himself. The FBI phoned Polk Correctional and told the warden to search Melton's cell. When Melton saw guards approaching, he barricaded the door and smashed his phone to pieces. It would take days to recover data from the device. There was nothing the FBI could do to force Melton to cooperate with the investigators. He was already in prison for life. There was no additional information to be gleaned from any cell phone records. Agents had looked at surveillance tapes from the stores where the burner phones had been purchased and had scrutinized footage from cameras overlooking roads near Jansen's house. None of it was helpful. The FBI had hundreds of pieces of information. There were numerous dots, but nothing to connect them. Some agents hoped the FBI's new computer system, a piece of complex software named Sentinel, might help unearth connections they had overlooked. Others were more skeptical. More than a decade earlier, the Bureau had started building technologies that officials had promised would provide powerful new tools for solving crimes. Most of those efforts, however, were failures. One notable effort was abandoned in 2005 after $170 million was spent creating a search engine that crashed constantly. Another attempt was suspended in 2010 after auditors concluded it would cost millions more simply to figure out why the system wasn't working. A few years before Jansen was kidnapped, the agency's databases were still so outdated that most agents didn't even bother inputting the bulk of the information they collected during investigations. Instead, they used paper files and index cards, like their predecessors decades before. Then, in 2012, the Bureau had rolled out Sentinel. Simply put, it was a system for sorting and managing evidence, clues, witness testimony, and the tens of thousands of other little pieces of information agents collected every day. Sentinel was tied into analytical engines and databases that the Bureau and other law enforcement agencies had developed to look for patterns. The software's development had been overseen by a young man from Wall Street who had convinced the FBI to hire him by arguing that the Bureau needed to draw on lessons from companies such as Toyota and methods such as lean manufacturing and agile programming. He had promised he could get Sentinel working in less than 2 years with a handful of software engineers. And then he had delivered. Now Sentinel was functional. No one working on the Janssen case was certain if it would provide any help, but they were desperate. One of the agents began inputting each piece of information they had collected thus far, and then sat back to see if Sentinel would spit anything useful out. 2. When Rick Madrid showed up for his job interview at the old General Motors plant, he wore mirrored shades, an Iron Maiden t-shirt, and a pair of cut-off jeans he had once described as the greatest aphrodisiac in Northern California. It was 1984. Out of courtesy toward his interviewers, and because Madrid wanted this job, he had combed his beard and put on deodorant. He drew the line, however, at wearing sleeves that covered his tattoos. Madrid was familiar with the plant in Fremont, California, because he had worked there until 2 years earlier, when GM had shut it down. Fremont was known, locally and nationally, as the worst auto factory in the world. 8 hours a day for 27 years, Madrid had pounded rims into place with a sledgehammer, proselytized about the greatness of the United Auto Workers, and served rounds of magic screwdrivers, a high-octane mixture of vodka and orange juice that he poured into plastic cups wedged into car frames so co-workers could partake as the vehicles progressed down the line. Fremont's assembly conveyors always moved smoothly, so the drinks hardly ever spilled. The bags of ice he put in the vehicle's trunks often warped the liners, but that was the problem of whoever bought the car. "Work was an interruption in my leisure time," Madrid later said. "I was there to earn money. I really didn't care about the quality of the job, and neither did GM. They just wanted to get as many cars out as they could." When Madrid showed up for this interview, however, he suspected things might be different this time. GM was partnering with the Japanese automaker Toyota to reopen the Fremont plant. For Toyota, this was a chance to build cars inside the United States and expand the company's sales in America. For General Motors, it was an opportunity to learn about the famed Toyota production system, which was producing cars of very high quality at very low costs in Japan. One hitch in the partnership was that GM's agreement with the UAW dictated that the plant had to hire at least 80% of its workers from employees who had been laid off 2 years earlier. So Madrid and his friends were showing up, one by one, to interview with New United Motor Manufacturing Inc., or NUMMI. Madrid figured he was a good candidate, because his on-the-job drinking, truth be told, was tame compared to the antics of his former colleagues. Yes, he may have gotten drunk and had sex in the warehouse where they stored Chevy seats, but unlike many of his co-workers, he didn't snort coke while attaching brake pads or smoke weed from bongs built from muffler parts. He hadn't been a patron of the parking lot RV where prostitutes offered services perfectly timed to union-mandated work breaks. Nor had Madrid ever deliberately sabotaged a vehicle like those who put empty whiskey bottles and loose screws behind door panels so they would bang around after the cars were sold. The saboteurs were an extreme example of a fierce war that had consumed the Fremont plant in the GM days. Workers weren't above dirty tactics if they thought it would strengthen their union's hand. Employees knew that as long as they kept the assembly line moving, no one was likely to get punished for misbehavior, no matter how egregious. At GM, all that really mattered was keeping production on pace. Employees sometimes discovered mistakes on cars as they moved along the conveyor belt, but rather than stop and fix the problems, they would mark the vehicle with a wax crayon or a post-it note and let it continue on its way. Eventually, those fully assembled autos would be hauled into the back lot and taken apart to repair the error. Once, a worker had a heart attack and fell into the pit as a car passed over. Everyone waited for the vehicle to rumble along before they pulled him out. They all knew the plant's fundamental law: the line doesn't stop. Madrid's first interview occurred in a small conference room. Across the table was a representative from the UAW, two Toyota executives from Japan, and a GM manager. Everyone exchanged pleasantries. They asked Madrid about his background and gave him some basic math and assembly problems to test his knowledge of auto manufacturing. They asked if he intended to drink while working. No, he said. He was done with that. It was a relatively brief conversation. Then, as he was walking out, one of the men from Japan asked Madrid what he had disliked about the plant when he worked there last time. Rick Madrid had never been shy about speaking his mind. He didn't like working on cars he knew had problems, he told them, because whatever he was doing would have to be undone to repair a mistake. He didn't like that his suggestions were always ignored by his superiors. Once, he said, when a new tire mounting machine was being installed, he had come up with an idea for putting the controls in a different place to speed up work. He even sought out an engineer to show him a diagram of the concept. But when he came back from lunch, the new machine was in place with the controls in their original location. I operated from the left side of the tire machine. All the controls were on the right side, he told the interviewers. Thank goodness that engineer didn't build bridges. When the plant was run by GM, workers were just cogs in a machine, Madrid told them. You were just there to do what they told you to do, he said. Nobody ever asked him his opinion or cared what he thought. He expressed all these frustrations to his interviewers and then kicked himself on the long drive home. He really needed this job. He should have kept his mouth shut. A few days later, Madrid got the call. The Japanese executives had appreciated his honesty and were offering him a job. First, though, he would have to go to Japan for 2 weeks and learn about the Toyota production system. 16 days later, Numi flew Madrid and about 24 other workers to the Takaoka auto plant outside Toyota City, Japan, the first in a series of trips nearly every employee at Numi would take. When Madrid walked into the Japanese factory, he saw familiar assembly lines and heard the recognizable sounds of pneumatic tools hissing and buzzing. Why had they bothered flying him across the world to train inside a factory just like the one at home? After a basic tour and an orientation meeting, Madrid walked onto the factory floor and watched one man put bolts into door frames over and over with an air-powered gun. By the time each car rolled off the line, Madrid knew, those bolts would be buried under layers of metal and plastic. It was just like California, except the signs were in Japanese and the bathrooms were much cleaner. Then, the worker manning the pneumatic gun pushed a bolt into place, applied his tool, and an ugly squeal sounded. The bolt had misthread the hole, a common mistake, and was stuck halfway in the door frame. Madrid expected the man to signal the defect by marking the door, like they did at GM, so the car could be eventually towed to a back lot and repaired. The problem with that system, however, was that replacing the bolt would require disassembling the door, repairing the mistake, and then rebuilding everything. The trim would be less snug in the vehicle's frame afterward. Whoever bought the car wouldn't notice at first, but after a few years, the door would start jiggling. It would be a shoddier vehicle. When the screw gun squealed inside the Japanese plant, though, something unexpected happened. The worker who made the mistake reached above his head and pulled a hanging cable that turned on a spinning yellow light. He then reversed the direction of his screw gun and pulled the bolt out of the door frame, grabbed another tool, and used it to smooth the hole's threads. At this point, A manager walked over, stood behind the worker, and began asking questions. The worker ignored his boss except to bark out a few orders, and then grabbed another tool to rethread the hole. The conveyor belt was still moving, but the worker hadn't finished his repair. When the door got to the end of the worker's station, the entire assembly line stopped. Madrid had no idea what was going on. Another man, clearly a senior manager, came over. Instead of yelling, he laid out a new bolt and equipment on a tray, like a nurse in an operating room. The worker kept issuing orders to his superiors. In Fremont, that would have gotten him slugged. Here, though, there were no angry shouts or anxious whispers. The other men on the line were calmly standing in place or double-checking parts they had just installed. No one seemed surprised at what was happening. Then the worker completed his rethreading, put a new bolt in the door, and pulled the cord above his head again. The assembly line started moving at normal speed. Everyone went back to work. "I just didn't believe it," Madrid said. "Back home, I had seen a guy fall in the pit, and they didn't stop the line. For so many years, I had learned you don't stop the line no matter what." He had been told it cost $15,000 a minute to pause an assembly line. But for Toyota, quality came before income. "That's when it dawned on me that we can do this. We can compete against these guys by learning what they do," Madrid said. One bolt changed my attitude. I felt that I could finally take pride in what I do. As Madrid continued his training in Japan, there were other surprises as well. One day he shadowed a worker who, midway through a shift, told a manager he had an idea for a new tool that would help him install struts. The manager walked to the machine shop and returned 15 minutes later with a prototype. The worker and manager refined the design throughout the day. The next morning, everyone had their own versions of the tool waiting at their stations. Madrid's trainers explained that the Toyota production system, which in the United States would become known as lean manufacturing, relied on pushing decision-making to the lowest possible level. Workers on the assembly line were the ones who saw problems first. They were closest to the glitches that were inevitable in any manufacturing process. So it only made sense to give them the greatest authority in finding solutions. Every person in an organization has the right to be the company's top expert at something, John Shook, who trained Madrid as one of Toyota's first Western employees, told me. "If I'm attaching mufflers, or I'm a receptionist, or a janitor, I know more about exhaust systems, or receiving people, or cleaning offices, than anyone else. And it's incredibly wasteful if a company can't take advantage of that knowledge. Toyota hates waste. The system was built to exploit everyone's expertise." When Toyota had first proposed this management philosophy to General Motors, the Americans literally laughed at their naivete. "Maybe that approach works in Japan," they said, "but it would fail in California." Workers at the Fremont plant didn't care about contributing expertise. What they cared about was doing as little work as possible. But the only way we would agree to the partnership was if GM promised to give this a try, said Shook. "Our basic philosophy was that no one goes to work wanting to suck. If you put people in a position to succeed, they will. What we didn't say was that if we couldn't figure out how to export the Toyota production system, we were screwed," Shook said. "It's the culture that makes Toyota successful, not hanging cords or prototyping tools. If we couldn't export a culture of trust, we had no other ideas. So we sent everyone to America and prayed it would work." In 1994, two business school professors at Stanford began studying how, exactly, one creates an atmosphere of trust within a company. For years, the professors, James Barron and Michael Hannon, had been teaching students that a firm's culture mattered as much as its strategy. The way a business treats workers, they said, was critical to its success. In particular, they argued that within most companies, no matter how great the product or loyal the customers, things would eventually fall apart unless employees trusted one another. Then, each year, a few students would ask for evidence that supported those claims. The truth was, Barron and Hannon believed their assertions were true, but they didn't have much data to back them up. Both men were trained as sociologists and could point to studies showing the importance of culture in making employees happy or recruiting new workers or encouraging a healthy work-life balance. But there were few papers showing how a company's culture impacted profitability. So in 1994, they embarked on a multi-year project to see if they could prove their assertion right. First, though, they needed to find an industry that had lots of new companies they could track over time. It occurred to them that the flurry of technology startups appearing in Silicon Valley might provide the perfect sample. At the time, the internet was in its infancy. Most Americans thought the @ sign was something to ignore on a keyboard. Google was still just a number spelled G-O-O-G-O-L. We weren't inherently interested in tech, and we had no idea the companies we were studying would become big deals, said Barron, who now teaches at Yale. We just needed startups to study, and there were tech companies getting founded nearby, and so every morning we would buy the San Jose Mercury News and go through each page, and whenever a young company was mentioned, we would put our team into pursuit to find a phone number or mailing address, and then send someone to see if the CEO would answer a questionnaire. Over time, as they put it in a study they later wrote, without realizing it when we started our study in 1994 to 1995, we assembled the most comprehensive database to date on the histories, structures, and HR practices of high-tech companies in Silicon Valley, just as the region was about to witness an economic and technological boom of historic proportions. The project ended up taking 15 years and examining close to 200 firms. Their surveys looked at almost every variable that might influence a startup's culture, including how employees were recruited, how applicants were interviewed, how much people were paid, and which workers executives decided to promote or fire. They watched college dropouts become billionaires, and in other cases, high-flying executives crash and burn. Eventually, they collected enough data to conclude that most companies had cultures that fell into one of five categories. One was a culture they referred to as the STAR model. At these firms, executives hired from elite universities or other successful companies and gave employees huge amounts of autonomy. Offices had fancy cafeterias and lavish perks. Venture capitalists love STAR model companies because giving money to the A-team, conventional wisdom held, was always the safest bet. The second category was the engineering model. Inside firms with engineering cultures, there weren't many individual STARs, but engineers, as a group, held the most sway. An engineering mindset prevailed in solving problems or approaching hiring decisions. This is your stereotypical Silicon Valley startup, with a bunch of anonymous programmers drinking Mountain Dew at their computers, said Barron. They're young and hungry, and might be the next generation of stars once they prove themselves. But right now, they're focused on solving technical problems. Engineering-focused cultures are powerful because they allow firms to grow quickly. Think of how fast Facebook expanded, said Barron. When everyone comes from a similar background and mindset, you can rely on common social norms to keep everyone on the same path. The third and fourth categories of companies included those firms built around bureaucracies and those constructed as autocracies. In the bureaucratic model, Cultures emerged through thick ranks of middle managers. Executives wrote extensive job descriptions, organizational charts, and employee handbooks. Everything was spelled out, and there were rituals, such as weekly all-hands meetings, that regularly communicated the firm's values to its workers. An autocratic culture is similar, except that all the rules, job descriptions, and organizational charts ultimately point to the desires and goals of one person, usually the founder or CEO. One autocratic chief executive told us that his cultural model was, "You work, you do what I say, you get paid," Barron said. The final category was known as the commitment model, and it was a throwback to an age when people happily worked for one company their entire life. Commitment CEOs say things like, "I want to build the kind of company where people only leave when they retire or die," said Barron. That doesn't necessarily mean the company is stodgy, but it does imply a set of values that might prioritize slow and steady growth. Some Silicon Valley executives told Barron they saw commitment firms as outdated, remnants of a corporate paternalism that had undermined industries such as American manufacturing. Commitment companies were more hesitant to lay people off. They often hired HR professionals when other startups were using precious dollars to recruit engineers or salespeople. Commitment CEOs believe that getting the culture right is more important at first than designing the best product, Barron said. Over the next decade, Barron and Hannon kept close tabs on which startups thrived and which ones stumbled. About half the firms they studied remained in business for at least a decade. Some became the most successful companies in the world. Barron and Hannon's goal was to see if particular corporate cultures were more likely to correlate with success. They were unprepared, however, for how dramatically the impact of culture came through. Even in the fast-paced world of high-tech entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley, founders' employment models exert powerful and enduring effects on how their companies evolve and perform, the researchers wrote in 2002 in the journal California Management Review. The enormous impact of cultural decisions is evident even after taking account of numerous other factors that might be expected to affect the success or failure of young technology ventures, such as company age, size, access to venture capital, changes in senior leadership, and the economic environment. Just as Barron and Hannon had suspected, the STAR model produced some of the study's biggest winners. As it turned out, putting all the smartest people in the same room could yield vast influence and wealth. But, unexpectedly, STAR firms also failed in record numbers. As a group, they were less likely to make it to an IPO than any other category, and they were often beset by internal rivalries. As anyone who has ever worked in such a company knows, infighting is often more vicious inside a STAR-focused firm because everyone wants to be the STAR. In fact, when Barron and Hannon looked at their data, they found the only culture that was a consistent winner were the commitment firms. Hands down, a commitment culture outperformed every other type of management style in almost every meaningful way. "Not one of the commitment firms we studied failed," said Barron. "None of them, which is amazing in its own right. But they were also the fastest companies to go public, had the highest profitability ratios, and tended to be leaner with fewer middle managers, because when you choose employees slowly, you have time to find people who excel at self-direction. Employees in commitment firms wasted less time on internal rivalries because everyone was committed to the company rather than to personal agendas. Commitment companies tended to know their customers better than other kinds of firms, and as a result, could detect shifts in the market faster. Despite its being widely pronounced dead in Silicon Valley in the mid-1990s, the commitment model fares very well in our sample, the researchers wrote. Venture capitalists love STAR firms because when you're investing in a portfolio of companies, All you need are a few huge successes, Barron told me. But if you're an entrepreneur and you're betting on just one company, then the data says you're much better off with a commitment-focused culture. One of the reasons commitment cultures were successful, it seemed, was because a sense of trust emerged among workers, managers, and customers that enticed everyone to work harder and stick together through the setbacks that are inevitable in any industry. Most commitment companies avoided layoffs unless there was no other alternative. They invested heavily in training. There were higher levels of teamwork and psychological safety. Commitment companies might not have had lavish cafeterias, but they offered generous maternity leaves, daycare programs, and work-from-home options. These initiatives were not immediately cost-effective, but commitment firms valued making employees happy over quick profits. And as a result, workers tended to turn down higher-paying jobs at rival firms. And customers stayed loyal because they had relationships that stretched over years. Commitment firms dodged one of the business world's biggest hidden costs: the profits that are lost when an employee takes clients or insights to a competitor. Good employees are always the hardest asset to find, said Barron. When everyone wants to stick around, you've got a pretty strong advantage. The first thing Rick Madrid did upon returning to California was tell everyone what he had seen in Japan. He talked about the hanging cables, called andon cords, and about how managers took commands from workers instead of the other way around. He described watching assembly lines stop because some mechanic decided he needed more time to rebolt the door. He declared that everything at the Fremont plant was about to change now that Numi was in charge. His friends were skeptical. They had heard this story before. GM had often said the company valued employee input, until employees began recommending changes that management didn't want to hear. In the weeks before the Numi plant opened, the factory's workers made sure their union memberships were up to date and held meetings to discuss tactics for fighting management if it came to that. They voted to create a Numi work stoppage fund to pay for workers' expenses if they went on strike. They demanded, and Numi immediately agreed to provide, a formal system for filing grievances. Then Numi's management announced the company's layoff policy. New United Motor Manufacturing, Inc. recognizes that job security is essential to an employee's well-being, read the company's agreement with United Auto Workers. The company agrees that it will not lay off employees unless compelled to do so by severe economic conditions that threaten the long-term viability of the company. Numi promised it would cut executive pay rather than fire workers and train people to sweep floors, repair machines, or serve meals in the cafeteria to preserve their jobs. Every employee complaint and suggestion, no matter how far-fetched or expensive, would be implemented, or a response would be publicly posted explaining why not. Every team was given authority to change their station's layouts and workflow. Anyone, at any time, could stop the assembly line if they saw a problem. No American car company had ever made so public a promise to avoid layoffs and respond to worker complaints. Skeptical workers said that such pledges were easy to make when the plant wasn't even operating yet, but they grudgingly agreed to play along. The factory began producing Chevy Novas on December 10, 1984. Rick Madrid was assigned to a team that stamped out hoods and doors from giant sheets of steel. It was immediately clear to him that things were different. People who once sought trysts in the storage room kept their hands to themselves. There was no obvious drinking on the job. The RV hadn't returned to the parking lot. People were scared to try anything. They didn't want to push their luck. This hesitancy, however, also had less useful consequences. No one was pulling andon cords or making suggestions because no one was eager to cost the factory $15,000 a minute. No one was sure it wouldn't cost them their job. A month after the plant reopened, Tetsuro Toyoda, Numi's president, whose grandfather had founded Toyota in 1933, walked the Fremont floor. He saw an employee struggling to install a taillight that was wedged into a car frame at an odd angle. Toyoda approached the worker and, reading the name stitched on his uniform, said, "Joe, please pull the cord." "I can fix this, sir," Joe said. "Joe, please pull the cord." Joe had never pulled an Andon cord. No one in his area had. Since the plant had opened, there had been only a few cord pulls, and one of those had been an accident. "Sir, I can fix this," Joe said, working furiously to pop the taillight into place. Joe's team leader was standing nearby. That man's manager had been shadowing Toyoda as he walked through the factory, so he was orbiting nearby as well. When Joe glanced up, he saw a half dozen of the plant's most senior executives staring back. "Joe, please," Toyoda said. Then he stepped over, took Joe's hand in his own, and guided it to the Andon cord, and together they pulled. A flashing light began spinning. When the chassis reached the end of Joe's station without the taillight correctly in place, the line stopped moving. Joe was shaking so much, he had to hold his crowbar with both hands. He finally got the taillight positioned and, with a terrified glance at his bosses, reached up and pulled the Andon cord, restarting the line. Toyoda faced Joe and bowed. He began speaking in Japanese. "Joe, please forgive me," a lieutenant translated. "I have done a poor job of instructing your managers of the importance of helping you pull the cord when there is a problem. You are the most important part of this plant. Only you can make every car great. I promise I will do everything in my power to never fail you again." By lunchtime, everyone inside the factory had heard the story. The next day, Andon cords were pulled more than a dozen times. The next week, more than two dozen times. A month later, the plant was averaging nearly 100 pulls a day.